Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, March 14th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, you are also covering South by Southwest, so I appreciate you taking a break to talk about some movie news with me. How's it going for you so far at the festival?
I've seen some good stuff, I've seen some bad stuff, and I will talk about it at length in a future episode, I think, maybe when
everything's all wrapped up. Yes, I'm excited about that. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's talk about, a bunch of news items that have come out over the past few days. I think this came out late last night, early this morning. A canceled Star Wars movie has just been uncanceled. That is, if we believe exactly what the director has to say. So Patty Jenkins is the director in question here. She was, longtime listeners of the show will probably remember, she was attached to direct a Star Wars movie called Rogue Squadron, which is about a bunch of X-Wing pilots. And there was even like an official announcement made by Lucasfilm. There's a video put out. She released this information about how, you know, like
super teaser, like the most elaborate, like movie doesn't exist yet, here's a teaser thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, she was in like a flight suit and had the whole, you know, look of it. And there was, there were actual planes involved in the making of that video, if I remember correctly. She was talking about how her father was a pilot of some sort, so she has like a personal connection to this material. And then ultimately that project ended up just sort of like falling through the cracks and not happening, and Lucasfilm sort of repositioned its priorities and shifted more into making stuff in the Mandalorian verse and devoting more resources to streaming stuff and not really working on movies very much recently, although that has sort of since revamped back up in a way. There are several things in development right now. Anyway, all this is to say is that on a recent appearance of the Talking Pictures podcast, Patty Jenkins basically said that she was still working on this Rogue Squadron movie, which is a surprise because I think we had reported and there had been a bunch of talk about how that movie was like essentially dead as it could possibly be. But she essentially is just saying, and I'm not going to read her exact quote here, but she was basically saying like, you know, I left Star Wars to do Wonder Woman 3. That ended up falling apart. But Lucasfilm and I came together and said we had to finish the deal that we started. And so that was like right around the time that the strike was happening last year. And so her quote is, so now I owe a draft of Star Wars. So we'll see what happens there. So I don't know. All of this, Jacob, this just sort of seems like an unconventional arc for a project like this. And I was just curious what your take on this whole thing was.
My take is that this is a very unusual story, and I'm not so sure what to make of it or make of this quote. I mean, I don't want to say too much, but I will say that there are certain things we can't say on this show that have us wondering what the heck is going on here. Mm-hmm. And I'll leave it, the details there, other than to say I would be very surprised if this movie is actually back from the dead. I would be less surprised if this is Jenkins trying to maybe get interest in it to get it back from the dead.
And that, I mean, there's a long history of that kind of thing happening in Hollywood too. I think we talked about that in a recent episode of the podcast, or maybe Ryan and I did, about like the Deadpool basically like coming into existence as a movie because of a leaked, you know, video sort of teaser thing about that. And there have been so many times where people like, I don't know, Vin Diesel and any number of actors have basically just like talked themselves up into in the press in terms of like trying to talk their way into a role sort of off screen, and it ended up happening. So, you know, there would definitely be a lot of precedent for that if this is just her attempt to like actually try to gin up some interest in the story. But I guess my question for you then, Jacob, is like, are you interested in seeing a Rogue Squadron Star Wars movie?
Yeah, I am. The pitch was really strong, and that elaborate teaser really sold me on Jenkins' passion for what is clearly a personal project for her. I mean, don't we all want to see a Star Wars movie with the tone of Top Gun Maverick? I know I do. I am really interested in Jenkins as a filmmaker and interested in his concept. I'm not ready to believe this ever actually gets made. But, you know what?
Yeah, and there's been obviously like a ton of Star Wars projects that have been announced and never come to fruition. I mean, there's probably an entire like Wikipedia page or something devoted to a bunch of those over the years. So yeah, we're definitely in like wait and see mode on this. Something that I'm really curious to know what your take on this next story is, Jacob, because I know that you're a big fan of Alan Ritchson, who plays Reacher in the Amazon Prime Video Reacher show, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger. So these two actors, Schwarzenegger and Richson, are teaming up to make a Christmas comedy movie. But before I even get into what it's about, what do you think about those two personalities sharing the screen together?
It makes total sense, honestly. I mean, Schwarzenegger has spent the past, 20 some odd years since his first retirement from Hollywood to become a politician, and is dipping his toe back in and out, has been more of a figurehead, more of a statesman, more of a booster for other actors and other projects than necessarily his own leading man. I mean, outside of a handful of Terminator things, which, people will have opinions on those. I won't share them here right now. His whole thing has been to lend credence or gravity to somebody else. So since Alan Ritchson is kind of the hot new deal right now, Reacher's a huge hit for Prime Video. He's a good actor, and he's also another super muscle-bound, beefy action actor. It makes sense that Arnold Schwarzenegger, in this mode of his career, in his 70s, where his attention seems to be more on uplifting others as opposed to necessarily making himself into a consistent big deal, it would make sense that he would share a screen with them. But I will say that the premise of this film, which I'm sure you'll go to in a second, is the most 90s ass thing I've heard in a bit. And actually, I'm actually pretty excited about this, actually.
Yeah, so it's a Christmas comedy. I believe the working title right now is The Man with the Bag. And I'm just going to read you the log line here. So when Santa's magic bag is stolen, he turns to his naughty list to find Vance, a former thief, to help him get it back. Along with his daughter, Santa, and a group of misfit elves, Vance will have to pull off the greatest heist of his life to save Christmas. So I guess unclear which person is playing, which character here. I'm guessing Schwarzenegger is probably going to be Santa. That just seems like
the original Deadline report said specified that it's highly likely that Schwarzenegger is playing Santa Claus, which makes sense. I mean, this elderly, imposing, Teutonic figure, Schwarzenegger in his 70s, I think absolutely can play somebody who seems like he's from a different time. And that's what Santa Claus should be. He should be a figure who stepped out of time. And another part feels like just absolutely the kind of thing that Ritchson would play. And this is a prime production. Amazon money is making it. So it's very much like, we have this guy who's our biggest star right now. Let's put him in another thing. That's clearly what's happening. This 100% feels like the kind of thing that in the 90s, Danny DeVito would have been Santa Claus and Arnold Schwarzenegger would have been the thief. Like this would have been made in 95. And count me in for this kind of 1990s nonsense.
Yeah, I like the premise. I like these two actors. The only thing that gives me some hesitation is the director here, which is Adam Shankman, who has directed movies like A Walk to Remember, which I liked, but that's not really this type of movie at all. The Pacifier, Hairspray, the 2007 version of that. He directed Rock of Ages, the Tom Cruise musical in 2012, and like What Men Want and Disenchanted recently. So like not exactly like I would say a top tier like A-list filmmaker, but no, I don't know, maybe. we'll see how this one pans out, but maybe it's maybe he'll be able to sort of elevate the ridiculousness or at least like be like create a vibe that really works for this premise. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, so the next thing here is that Matt Reeves's The Batman Part 2 has been delayed a full year. So this movie was originally supposed to come out in October of 2025, and this week it was announced that it's going to be bumped all the way back to October of 2026. As Warner Brothers tries to basically like figure out what the heck they're doing with this new DC universe. I guess just like top line takeaway here, Jacob, do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing for Matt Reeves' movie?
I mean, considering the mess of things right now, it's a really tough question because on one hand, more time to make a good movie, more time to let the dust clear on what's happening at Warner Brothers. But also, it's also a double-edged sword because with the dust clearing at Warner Brothers means corporate shakeups, change of ownership, somebody buys Warner Brothers. Was that person want to be in the Matt Reeves business? Do they see Robert Pattinson as the future of Batman? So the fact that there's been a delay, you know, more time to make a good movie, but also more time for somebody up top to decide that the DC plan isn't working, or having two Batman, which you can get to in a second, it can be really confusing. And I really like the first Matt Reeves' first Batman movie, like a lot. Like, the more I watch it, the more I'm convinced it may be my favorite Batman movie overall, which is crazy to think
really
about.
Great. Yeah.
But it's, I would love to see more of this particular shade of Batman, but I just, does this delay also mean that Warner Bros. Is waiting to see how James Gunn's Superman movie looks, trying to say maybe we just nip the other Batman universe in the bud because we want to have our new Batman? Or does it mean that they reconsider and say maybe we don't have two ongoing Batmen and we somehow make Rob Pattinson's movies fit the universe of Superman that James Gunn's building, which seems wild. I don't know how you make that work considering how the tone of the Reeves film. But I don't know, Ben. All I know is that Warner Bros. Is clearly figuring things out. They're putting a real Hail Mary on James Gunn delivering a Superman, and I'm excited for that film. And I really do think that what happens with that movie is going to determine a lot about what happens with Matt Reeves. Not necessarily the release of it, but the production of it, how it looks. I think that people are having some very intense conversations at Warner Bros. Right now about all of this.
Yeah, for sure. So the thing that you've sort of been dancing around a little bit is Andy Muschietti, who directed The Flash most recently, has been attached to direct a movie called The Brave and the Bold, which we've talked about on the podcast before, but it's been a while since we've mentioned it. And that's the movie that is supposed to introduce the newly cast Batman of the DC universe, the official sort of canonical story that James Gunn and Peter Safran are trying to tell with their pressing the relaunch reset button, getting rid of all the Zack Snyder stuff and everything that came before, and moving forward with Superman being the first film out of the gate for that project. And so there's going to be a new Batman that they have not cast yet in that movie. And now with this delay, bumping it all the way back to the Batman Part 2, bumping that all the way back to 2026, I'm curious if The Brave and the Bold is going to come out before the Batman Part 2. And then, yeah, that just gets a little bit into that confusion that you were talking about earlier. Like, we've had stuff like this happen before. I mean, with like multiple Jokers on screen at the same time, basically, or in the same era. And that tended to, I mean, it worked out pretty well for Todd Phillips' Joker movie, which made over $1 billion. So like, I guess you could point to that and say like, hey, it's fine. Audiences aren't going to get that confused. You know, they weren't like, people weren't rioting in the streets going, hey, where's Jared Leto? He played the Joker in Suicide Squad. Like, why, you know, why is he not in this movie or whatever? So I guess it just could come down to being a challenge for their marketing team to try to figure out how to like directly appeal to people in the way that makes the most sense for whatever movie they're working on. With these superheroes that have, you know, multiple versions floating around, and some are canon in the DCU and some aren't and all that. But I don't know. Do you have any other like observations about this whole mess right now?
My whole observation, this is going to make me sound like a cranky old man, is a preview of my Subway Southwest coverage. But I saw The Fall Guy. My review is on /film.com right now, and I loved it. I had such an amazing time with The Fall Guy, the most straight up entertaining, like, mainstream non-sequel release I've seen in God a long time. And there was a moment deep in it where I felt relaxed and happy watching it, and I had this weird feeling after when I noted my relaxation and happiness, where I realized I am not having to think about universes or continuity or there being more than one Batman. I'm not having to recall, you know, or anticipate. There's no homework with The Fall Guy. It is just a film made to be a pleasurable experience for an audience. And as much as I like superhero stuff, the homework fatigue is very real. And I was very, like, I was high. I'm feeling like I was just allowed to have fun with The Fall Guy and not have to write an essay.
Yeah.
Continuity. So I just gotta say, Warner Brothers, please be careful, because I would love to love Superman movie. I would love to love Batman too, but just the feeling I had watching that movie was one that I would like to have again more than I would like to have another superhero universe.
Yeah. I'm like so curious to see what this DC universe thing looks like. And as you mentioned, you know, there's been like rumors of Warner Brothers even potentially going up for sale, like as early as next month, I think, is like when they can actually have those conversations to be either acquired or like acquire other things or whatever. So like there's so much confusion and sort of like hesitancy in the entertainment industry market right now, because nobody really knows what the next few months are going to bring. And then obviously that could create a tidal wave of executive changes and decision-making that completely, you know, upends the stuff even further. So, we'll have to, you know, see how this all shakes out, but I loved Matt Reeves, the Batman, and it was one of my favorite movies of that year. And I can't wait to see what part two looks like if he actually ends up getting to make it. And I hope he does. I hope they're able to sort of make everybody feel like they're getting what they want out of this whole thing. So fingers crossed for that. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right, so another piece of news that I think probably impacts you more than me, Jacob, since you're more of a horror fan than I am, is that Scream 7 seems to have gotten a shot in the arm recently. This movie has, I guess, undergone quite a ride over the course of its development. There was that whole thing about Melissa Barrera leaving the movie, Jenna Ortega left the movie, Christopher Landon, the director of the Happy Death Day movies, signed on and then had to walk away from the movie, basically. So there's just been like a lot of chaos around the next Scream film. But now Neve Campbell has said that she is going to be coming back to reprise her role as Sydney Prescott in Scream 7. And this movie also has a new director in the form of Kevin Williamson, who wrote the original Scream. So what do you make of that?
What I make of this is that this is absolutely what happens when your previous iteration of your film explodes in the most public way possible. I like Scream 5, and I actually like Scream 6, which, you know, is a controversial opinion. But those movies did a really effective job of resetting the entire series and like really pointing an arrow toward a brand new direction. And now that the, you know, that new cast is gone, the only solution seems to be to retreat to nostalgia, to retreat to the past, to bring back Neve Campbell, even though this is where things get tricky, because Neve Campbell did not reprise the role of Sydney in Scream 6 because of salary disputes. She felt she wasn't being paid enough. And I can't comment on that other than to say that, you know, female talent in Hollywood is traditionally undervalued, and I'll leave it there. Mm-hmm. But her character had a really effective ending in Scream 3. You know, 20 some odd years ago, and felt like her story was over, and they brought her back for 4 and 5 with diminishing returns. I mean, this is a character who's kind of earned her happy ending, and there's not much left to do other than to kill her. And that's kind of my concern, is I remember when they brought back Jamie Lee Curtis for Halloween Resurrection, the 8th film in the original canon of Halloween before that got confusing. And she's only in for 15 minutes just for Michael Myers can kill her off. And it's like, oh yeah, there's a character who had an ending. She was definitively allowed to exit the franchise gracefully, and you brought her back for the nostalgia points and to kill her off. So I see this news and I go, would they kill Sydney off? A character who is like an empowered survivor who has had an ending 3 times now. Bringing her back to kill her off would be really insulting, but bringing her back and letting her survive another Scream is just the exact same thing we've seen so many times. So yeah, it's a very naked play of get excited about this movie again. We know that things very publicly went wrong and it all collapsed, but you know, here you go. And also Kevin Williamson, the guy from the original one, he's back. Kevin Williamson is a good writer. He's written some good scripts, also some bad scripts. But it's not like he's Wes Craven. It's not like they're bringing Wes Craven, you know, R.I.P. It's not like they're bringing back the original director because they can't. I can't speak to Kevin Williamson as a filmmaker. I could speak to Radio Silence, who made the past few of them, because they were just, they're phenomenal horror filmmakers before they took on Scream. I could speak to Wes Craven, of course, who made the first 4. So yeah, my response to this news, this is a big old shrug, honestly. It's really hard for me to get excited about Neve Campbell playing this character because I don't know how you make it interesting without pissing people off. And I'm one of the people who would be pissed off.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of like the insistence on Fox's part of just continuing to make Die Hard sequels for a long time. Like you're diminishing the John McClane character by putting him in these scenarios over and over again, because what made that character interesting in the beginning was he was like a regular guy who happened to be thrown into this extraordinary situation. And then by the time you get to, you know, A Good Day to Die Hard, where he's like, what am I doing, you know, fighting fighter jets in Russia or whatever the hell he's doing there, it's like you've lost the core of what that character is. And so yeah, it's what you're saying about the Sydney character. I've not seen all of the Scream movies. I've seen a majority of them, but what you're saying about the Sydney thing is it just sort of like putting her in a situation like this kind of feels like a lose-lose scenario here. Like you're either going to kill her off or you're going to torture her again, basically, by putting her through interacting with another serial killer. And like, how much can one character withstand after all these years? You know, it just seems kind of like a brutal decision there. But
it's not being fun. Like it's you've reached the point where I just get tired and sad for a horror protagonist. That's why the villains are always the main characters of long going horror franchises. I mean, that's why it's Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees and, you know, Jigsaw. Because they can die and come back. They can be miserable. They can be tortured, and we want to see them come back because they're the villains. I a really terrific horror hero is super rare because you have to like them, but you have to also like be okay with them suffering. And maybe that's the joke. That's the joke with Bruce Campbell in the Evil Dead movies, is that the joke is that he keeps getting beat up and gets back up, and the joke is that his life is miserable. I was thinking of, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren from the Conjuring films, but even those films like really openly acknowledge that those characters are putting themselves in harm's way as a career choice. But with Sydney, it's just like she has a family. The previous movie says she says that she has kids and a husband and is happily living in a completely normal life. I'm like, do we want to see that get disrupted for a third time now? I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, and Scream was Williamson's first produced screenplay, so there's like a cool full circle aspect to this news in a way. He also wrote stuff like I Know What You Did Last Summer and The Faculty, and he like obviously did a lot in TV. He created or developed shows like Dawson's Creek and The Vampire Diaries, but like I think so far he's only directed one movie, which is 1999's Teaching Mrs. Tingle, which I remember feeling like a big deal for my age group, but I never actually got around to seeing that movie. Did you ever see that one?
No, I remember I was young enough. I think I'm a little younger than you, Ben, by a couple of years. So when that matters, when at that age. But I remember seeing that poster and thinking, ooh, that's a movie for adults. I can't see that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I can't speak to Williamson's directorial prowess or what have you. But I'm very curious to see, like, if, you know, how the horror community responds to Scream 7, because I can very easily see this being a scenario where people, even though they're trying to, like you said, sort of use this naked nostalgia ploy almost, like, I could. The horror community can be kind of fickle at times and very vocal. So I can see this being a scenario where it sort of backfires and everybody just like turns on this franchise once and for all. So I know Paramount doesn't want that, but we'll have to wait and see how it all plays out. But okay, next thing is Emma Stone has a new movie that she's signed up to appear in. So Ari Aster's new film, Eddington, has locked in its main cast. So we knew that this movie would reteam Ari Aster with his Beau is Afraid star Joaquin Phoenix. And now this recent report says that Emma Stone, Pedro Pascal, and Austin Butler are also now on board. So the story, we don't really know, as is typical with Ari Aster productions, we don't really know a ton about them before they start. But the story has been described by Aster as a Western noir dark ensemble comedy. And production began this week on this. So I have to assume that you're at least excited about this prospect, Jacob. I know you're a fan of Ari Aster's work, so does this seem like something that that you're stoked about?
Yeah, I like Ari Aster a lot, and I'm very curious about what direction he takes with this movie, because Hereditary and Midsommar are both terrific movies, and they were you know, minor hits. I mean, A24 movies rarely make, you know, massive box office, but their horror stuff, when it hits, you know, tends to do modestly well. And those films both prove that, you know, there's an audience for him making horror movies. Then he made Beau Is Afraid, a far more expensive movie for A24, and one I actually really like a lot. But I acknowledge that it's not for all tastes. It's made for like a handful of people, mostly Ari Aster himself, to work out some stuff. And one thing that movie did not do box office, and also did not necessarily light the critical world on fire. You didn't see any nominations. It was not discussed at the end of the year stuff. It didn't, despite the audaciousness of it, I feel like it just was really overlooked in a lot of ways, including by Slash One. It didn't make a lot of personal lists on our site, but I do like it. So hearing this cast and hearing the genre description, I'm wondering, is this the kind of hard pivot that Ari Aster needs to make a film that's going to be a wee bit more accessible? And I say this as somebody who doesn't necessarily demand all films be accessible, but I'm simply saying that I think that Ari Aster could probably use something that people, but something that the more like a more casual audience member would want to see after.
Yeah.
So I am very curious about this, because I think it would behoove him and A24 to make a film that, you know, has the appeal of Hereditary and Midsommar, which I think are terrific movies on their own, but also are movies that, you know, you can recommend to a more casual movie fan and get excited about them. So I'm very curious about this movie just because of the talent involved. I'm especially curious about this as a business decision, because A24, you know, has expressed interest, you know, in broadening their scope. They have Civil War coming out. It's a, you know, a massive summer-sized movie. So I don't know. I would very much like to see Ari Aster have one toe in the mainstream again. And if that makes sense, if I'm not being too unfair to anybody here, Ben.
No, that makes sense to me. And I don't know if he's the type of filmmaker who would go into that that sort of old school pattern of like one for me, one for them kind of thing. I don't imagine Ari Aster is ever going to be like a one for them type of filmmaker to just make something that is more like straight down the middle or whatever. But, you know, his version of one for them, I think, is what you're talking about. And the idea of like Beau Is Afraid had Joaquin Phoenix and it had a good supporting cast, but it was like a lot of people, you know, from the theater community and like not necessarily like A-list top tier, like movie, quote unquote, movie star names. Right. But now with Joaquin Phoenix and Emma Stone and Pedro Pascal and Austin Butler, I mean, that's a lot of star power in this movie and a lot of different avenues for people to be excited about seeing this and a lot of different like potential entry points for audiences. So I think it's a smart piece of casting to gather all these folks together in this ensemble. And hopefully that will result in something that, that frankly makes a lot more money than Beau Is Afraid did, just so Ari Aster can continue to make his, you know, weird sort of singular, unique movies. So,
yeah, a little while ago on this podcast, I talked about the new Stanley Kubrick biography that I read, and you can listen to the episode if you want to hear more about it. But one of the things that took me by surprise is how often in his notes Kubrick would write about the commercial viability of a movie. He would like he abandons so many projects because he realizes, oh, audiences won't want this. This is not what people will see. And part of it was because he was his own producer and he ran his own production company as well as being a director. But if Kubrick is the kind of filmmaker who is obsessing over does the audience want this, then I have to imagine that at some level probably Ari Aster is too. So it's just one of those things that kind of made me rethink the artiste filmmaker a little
bit. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I didn't know that about Kubrick. That's like very enlightening to think about his career through that, you know, to think about him thinking about his career through that lens is fascinating. All right, last story here before we wrap up today. The trailer for The Crow has finally come out. Jacob, I think we've been writing about this movie on Slash Film since like 2008, I want to say, is the first time it appears in our archives in some fashion. And maybe it was like in development even before that. And Peter, you know, back in those early days of the site, just didn't really cover it or something back then. So I'm not sure exactly what year they started trying to get this thing going, but there have been so many different people attached to this project. I mentioned it on an episode of the podcast not too long ago that it just seems like one of those that we've been covering for, you know, a decade plus. And it actually has been that long and longer. But now this trailer is finally here. Bill Skarsgård is starring as the Crow. This is a remake of the 1994 movie that starred Brandon Lee, which is based on the comic book by James O'Barr. I was not impressed at all by this trailer, but what did you think of it? Are you like, do you have a more rosy outlook of this than I do?
No, I haven't watched the trailer yet, Ben. I couldn't be bothered to click on it. I actually like Bill Skarsgård. He's a really good actor, and I think there's room for him to flourish as the lead in movies. But Rupert Sanders is a filmmaker who I am consistently unimpressed with, and I don't like the idea of paying for a movie that has his name on it because I don't think he delivers the goods. Straight up. Mm. I know that's me being very blunt. I try to take things into account when I criticize filmmakers. But I think all of his movies have not been for me, to put it kindly, and I'm not so sure who they are for. I have no attachment to The Crow as a comic book character. I have never seen the original film either. This is a very big blind spot for me, other than, yes, I've been in this business since 2009, so I've literally been writing about a Crow reboot for my entire adult life. My entire career has been me at least once or twice a year. Oh, they cast a new Crow. In fact, we have an article coming to slashfilm.com today where we run down the history of the 12, 13, 14 actors who've all been attached to star in The Crow over the past decade plus. It's everybody. Every white man plus Jason Momoa was attached to star in The Crow at some point. And if you could name a white actor and Jason Momoa for the past 15 years, he's probably been attached to The Crow. So I think this movie, it's hard for me to be excited about a movie that felt like it got made out of some kind of contractual spreadsheet obligation where we got to make this because we can, as opposed to somebody actually being passionate about it. I mean, Rupert Sanders is not the kind of filmmaker who's going to strike me as a guy who's passionate about The Crow.
So, yeah. I mean, that's fair considering the projects that he's directed in the past. And like, yeah, you get the sense watching the trailer that like this feels like a movie that Lionsgate basically sunk so much money into in development that they just kind of had to get it across the finish line. And it feels like just really blah to me. Like it's super dark, but it also looks like they're desperately trying to recapture some of the John Wick energy. Even some of the framing in the shots look very Wickish to me, but it doesn't have that sort of sense of fun and playfulness that the John Wick movies have. It just seems incredibly dour, and I don't know, man. It feels like a movie that would have come out in, you know, 2006 or something, 2007. Like, I guess what I'm saying is this movie would have been better off if it would have been more like culturally relevant, probably, if it had come out when they first started developing it instead of continuing for whatever reason to try to get this thing across the finish line, because I just was not impressed by this at all. And I'm probably just going to skip this movie because it just looks like not even close to anything I would be interested in seeing, even though, like you, I appreciate Bill Skarsgård and have liked many of his performances, but this just feels really rough. So I don't know if we have any like diehard The Crow fans out there who are fans of either the comic or the original movies. I know there are some sequels and stuff. I think a lot of like directed to video sequels. Let me know what you think about this trailer, because like, is this the thing that you've been waiting for? I don't know. I just had the feeling of watching this of like, wow, they worked for that long and this is what we get, what we're getting. So I don't want to like denigrate any of the artists who work on this or whatever, but it just feels like, did this movie really need to happen? I don't know. Sorry to end on a downer note there, Jacob.
No. I think that the fact that The Crow has finally been released, I think, is the latest sign that the comic book movie superhero wave is really truly cresting, because The Crow would not have been made if people still wanted comic book movies right now. I think we're definitely entering the era of Spider-Man, Superman, Batman still getting regular movies, but you know, we're not going to see, you know, the more minor characters anymore. And I, even though he's not DC or Marvel, I think The Crow kind of fits the mold of the kind of thing you force through when everybody's making every super movie do a $1 billion hit. Mm-hmm. It's perfect for this movie with its history to have missed that wave by like 1 year.
Yeah, and if absolutely nothing else, at least you and I will never have to write a casting story for The Crow ever again. So
they're going to reboot it after this. give it to you after it comes out. They'll do it again.
Son of a bitch. Years. You're probably right. All right. Well, hopefully we'll this industry will still be around in 10 years for us to write about the Crow recasting again. But anyway, all right. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about every story that we mentioned at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.